The North Carolina Reading Service now presents the following program for our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners. That program is the Indie Week, the Independent, a weekly journal, and it is read today by John Federson, and the issue is dated January the 16th. Of 2026. And I'll start the broadcast out with a retraction. It's January the 15th where I'm recording this, Thursday, January the 15th. It will first be broadcast Friday afternoon, and then after that it'll turn into the podcast section, the same what I'm reading right now. So let's get started with the Indie Week of January 15th. North Carolina is one of the fastest growing states in the country. World-class universities, expensive state parks, proximity to an international airport, beach, mountains, and that sweet southern charm are big draws for the Tar Heel State. According to the NC Chamber Foundation, the number of households in the state will increase by 218,000 between 2024 and 2029. The state, therefore, needs a whopping 764,000 units, a mixture of for sale and rental housing, to meet such a high demand. Durham County is one of the places facing down the massive influx of residents to the state. The report says Durham ranks fourth in overall housing gap. That's the number of units needed to keep up with population growth, at about 33,000 units behind Mecklenburg, Wake, and Guilford counties. Low-income homeowners and renters are feeling the pressures most acutely. According to the Triangle Community Foundation, Durham is short roughly 25,000 units for low-income and working-class families. There are many paths to reaching the housing goals for Durham, each with its own merits and shortcomings. Nearly every solution involves a combination of public and private sector contributions and scales from accessory dwelling units and single-family homes to quadruplexes and, yes, even those gaudy high-rises. In 2019, Durham voters overwhelmingly supported a $95 million housing bond to facilitate the construction and restoration of hundreds of affordable housing units across the community. City officials also included $65 million in additional funding from the city's dedicated housing fund and federal dollars from the American Rescue Plan Act to round out that $160 million invested in a five-year affordable housing investment program, parts of which are still ongoing. While the city has a strong grasp of the impact the housing program has made on units created by those funds, there is limited and scattershot data on the entire housing landscape in Durham. Private developers, local nonprofits, and other organizations also play a role in increasing this housing stock. At the onset of the five-year affordable housing program, building new affordable housing units was a top priority. The city set a five-year goal of creating 1,600 new affordable rental units while also preserving 800. It exceeded both these goals. Almost $39 million went toward new construction and preservation, which allowed for the creation of over 1,000 new affordable rental units using funds from the Forever Home Bond and the Dedicated Housing Fund. Over half of those units were in partnership with the Durham Housing Authority, which rehabilitated its J.J. Henderson and Maureen Road developments, as well as constructed new units at the Vanguard and the Joyce. DHIC and Self-Help also contributed to two major projects, Ashton Place, which supports senior living, and Hardy Street Apartments, that's a 132-unit apartment complex in East Durham. Residents have already begun to inhabit most of those properties. and a multitude of other projects are also under contract. In total, 1,100 rental units, that is 900 affordable and 250 market rate units, are in the midst of construction now or rehabilitation, including phases 3 and 4 of the South Side projects near historic Haiti, more construction on the former Liberty Street apartment site, and 20 accessory dwelling units as part of a pilot program with Coram Houses. Lastly, over 500 affordable units are in the planning pipeline. The former Forest Hills Heights redevelopment is expected to create 185 of these, and the Villages of Haiti would add 250, bringing much-needed housing to neighborhoods on the periphery of downtown. But these future projects come with a much higher price tag due to their prime location. The city has allocated roughly $46.5 million for the 571 units planned, 571, more than it has already spent on the 1,600 built so far. More units will likely be maintained through the city's NOAH, NOAA, which means Naturally Occurring Affordable Housing Preservation Pilot Program. The city of Durham also surpassed other critical benchmarks by moving over 2,000 families into permanent housing and helping roughly 4,700 low-income renters and homeowners continue to stay where they live through rental assistance and home improvement programs. The city fell short thus far in reaching its goal of providing financial support for low-income home buyers. Only 125 of the 400-person goal have taken advantage of the program. Although the city hit the 5-year benchmark, some projects within Forever Home, Durham, are still ongoing. The story of Durham's growth is no longer a best-kept secret, and for every accolade the city receives, highlighting the Bull City as the best place to live, with James Beard winning restaurants, the cost of living has surged alongside them. Since 2019, the area median income, AMI, at nearly all levels is up 36%. This measure is used to set price levels for affordable units. For example, units in one apartment complex may be set aside for residents making 80% of that area median income. When the AMI goes up, the price of units available to residents making a percentage of that rise accordingly. While wages have increased, they haven't kept up with housing prices and cost of goods, and recent cuts to federal programs like USAID and the potential loss of Medicaid expansion at the state level is putting added pressure on families from a wide swath of Durham. But how does Durham's affordability stack up against its peers? According to the Durham Housing Dashboard, median home values in Minneapolis since 2014 have grown by $127,000, reaching $322,000 a decade later. In half that time, Durham home values jumped by $147,000, hitting over $400,000 in 2024. The sharp increase is due in part to Durham County's property revaluation schedule. After completing the reappraisal process last year, the county commissioners opted to amend the schedule to conduct revaluations every 4 years. By the way, the state requires revaluations at least every 8 years. And this was done in an effort to minimize the sticker shock that could come from long gaps between home appraisals. Rental costs have also increased in Durham. Tenants are paying roughly $400 more per month than they were in 2019, and many of those rental units are concentrated in the downtown area and often do not account for what housing advocates say is lacking in Durham, that is, workforce housing and mid-density options like duplexes, and that's known as missing middle housing. Still, Durham boasts commendable stats in important categories. Durham has a high homeownership rate compared to other peer cities. At 55%, Durham outpaces Minneapolis, Ann Arbor, Michigan, Portland, and Boston. Boston, which sits at just 35%. Durham also has a relatively moderate housing cost burden to both homeowners and rental tenants, according to the Durham Housing Dashboard. Housing cost burden occurs when residents must pay more than 30% of their incomes on housing costs. In Durham, 54% of homeowners with household incomes between $20,000 and $35,000 are considered cost burdened, compared to 75% in Minneapolis and 89% in Ann Arbor. At $50,000 to $75,000, 27% are cost burdened in Durham, but in Minneapolis it's 40%, and Portland 54%. Veterans of those Monday City Council meetings recognize a similar pattern of behavior. Private developers come before the dais to make their requests for an annexation or a rezoning of property, and in return, the City Council often rebuts with asks for affordable housing, either in the form of dedicated units set aside at a specific level of AMI, or by contributions to the city's dedicated housing fund. By North Carolina general statute, City Council cannot require private developers to build affordable housing, but developers can offer to include affordable housing as a sign of goodwill, particularly if they are local or frequently bring cases into City Hall. Developers can also take advantage of the city's density bonus that's outlined in a unified development ordinance, which raises the number of units they can build in a certain zoning district, provided that at least 15% of the units are affordable, measured by AMI, for a minimum of at least 30 years. Through these privately initiated proffers, Durham signed off on 766 income-restricted units through approved development plans in 2025, a significant bump from the 297 approved in the previous year. In addition, 470 additional affordable housing units were created through this density bonus, 474, and that's up from 74 units in 2024. As of 25, the total number of units for each category is 2177 and 898, respectively. Now, housing advocacy in Durham is a dangerous pool to swim in. Sharks lurk in the waters of public discourse and online forums. The issue was at the forefront of local elections last fall and continues to drive the conversation about Durham's long-term sustainability. If there's one thing that both YIMBYs and NIMBYs can't agree on, it's that Durham needs more housing at every level for rent and home ownership. How we get there is where the battle lines are drawn, and one tool that folks believe is the skeleton key that unlocks their desired outcomes is the Unified Development Ordinance, UDO. Since Durham City Councilors and County Commissioners passed that comprehensive plan in 2023, the Planning Department has been grinding away at rewriting the UDO, the legislative tool that governs land use in Durham, to better align with the goals set forth by the Comprehensive Plan, which is the visioning document that lays out what Durham residents want their neighborhoods to look and feel like. Proponents believe new zoning codes would give small local developers more flexibility to fill these gaps in the housing supply with accessory dwelling units, like quadruplexes and other types of housing that national home builders tend to shy away from. The new housing stock would also increase the tax base across Durham, increasing property tax revenue for the city and county to use on essential services. Skeptics see the UDO specifically upzoning as a path for an already wealthy and powerful group, developers, to get rich quick while increasing the financial strain on Durham's working class and pressures on the environment. Skeptics also want to rein in development, which some say the city council has been too quick to approve and give control back to residents, particularly on larger tracts of land like old shopping malls. The planning department plans to finalize a full UDO draft by this spring, after which the document will undergo immense scrutiny from residents and council members. No matter what the final draft looks like, it will not be a silver bullet. While the increase in supply will have an effect on market competition, it will not automatically solve Durham's affordability issues. City and county officials have hinted at putting another housing bond on the ballot in the near future, and different leadership at the state and federal levels could provide additional funding sources, but local officials can't not afford to wait and see. They will have to make do with the resources available to them if they hope to make a dent in Durham's housing shortfall. All right, let's shift gears a little bit, move to the state level. And this is about North Carolina's new state archivist, Kelly Policelli. Every year, staff at North Carolina State Archives field around 9,000 questions, according to Kelly Policelli, the state's new head archivist. Those questions might regard any number of things: family history, an old architectural survey, a News and Observer clip, a colonial court report, or any court report from the past 200 years of North Carolina's Supreme Court. Maybe someone just wants help tracking down an old college transcript. Policelli, who began her role in December following the retirement of longtime archivist Sarah Kuntz, is eager to brush the dust off documents and help answer questions. She said, over a Google Meet call with the Indy, "Archives are participatory. There's a lot of power in being an archivist and selecting material, but without the public participating, without agencies participating, this archive is not going to reflect the full history of North Carolina." She continued, "I want everyone to feel like this is their archive and to see themselves in our archives." Policelli previously served as an assistant librarian and coordinator of university archives and special collections at Elon University, and has worked with an impressive roster of other Tar Heel institutions, including Digital Durham at Duke University, the North Carolina State University Special Collections Research Center, and the University of North Carolina Photographic Archive. A month into the job, Policelli hopped on a call to chat about the ongoing need to advocate for public history, what people might find in the state archives, and how her office is preparing for the United States semi-quincentennial, better known as America 250. This interview, which is in Q&A form, has been edited for length and clarity. What is a day like in the life of the North Carolina State Archivist? "I'm a division director in a government agency," she responds. "It's a lot of meetings, reportings, and troubleshooting, which that alone might surprise people. I get the impression folks don't really understand what archivists and librarians do all day, but we are confronted with problems that we must solve. It's a lot of advocating for us, for what we do in our staff, because there's not a great level of archival literacy in terms of what it is that archives need in order to continuously operate, and then just making sure everyone has all the information and direction that they need to move forward with some of the more complex projects that we're working on. I met with a legal counsel already today and was talking with someone about some staff shakeups that we have and how they're going to affect the different units here because we all work together. We're always collaborating. We have folks here who do digitization of original records. We have folks who do digital preservation of materials that were born digital, meaning stuff that was never printed on paper, and for which we really only have a digital copy. We have people working on processing, which means going through collections, sorting them, figuring out if there's an original order, putting it into archival quality boxes and folders, so that some of the chemical processes that break down paper can be arrested to a certain extent. Some people are working specifically on outreach and thinking about programming the public might like. How does material enter the state archives? We have processes for that to happen. We have point people who work with each of the individual agencies, and then private donors who donate their materials to the archives, and that goes into our special collections. We have private papers there from organizations from around North Carolina, and we have photographic archives. This is one of the places where it gets technically complicated because all the things that make digital material great, the fact you can send it out, you can change it easily, it's easy to alter, share, and that kind of thing, makes it harder to capture and fix. We have a lot of things in place that make it possible for us to capture things on the digital side very easily, with a lot of information surrounding it that helps us to prove it is the thing it purports to be. On the paper side, it is a lot easier. People box stuff up. They give us a call. We get them to the right person. If it's in North Carolina, we schedule a pickup. If not, it gets a little bit more difficult, but we have a van. We take our van out. There's an archives van. There's an archives van. And then the next part is documentation. That's the bread and butter of what we do. It's kind of like an art collection. You need provenance information so that we can say, these came from this place on this date and this person signed off on it, and show that this was within the normal course of business. There have been lots of stories in North Carolina of materials that were supposed to be kept in the courthouse disappearing, going where they shouldn't go. We have a very strict public records laws here in North Carolina. We want to show a chain of custody to make people understand where the stuff came from. What resources do you think people would be surprised that your office offers? At this point, she responds, I'm so dialed into what we have, it's hard for me to say what would be surprising. We have a lot of county records, and I'm not sure that everybody knows that. We collect county records regularly. We have a lot of court records. We keep everything related to most superior court actions. We also have minutes from county boards. There is a lot of local history here that I'm not sure people realize they can access here at the archives. We have the News and Observer collection of photographs. We have different kinds of films from North Carolina all around the state. One of the other things we need to be more clear about is that we have multiple locations. We have special collections out in the Western region in Asheville that are accessible. One of the biggest collections is the Black Mountain College collection, which is really interesting. Then we have a facility, the Outer Banks History Center, that collects private collections and organizational collections from the Outer Banks region. That is a really rich collection I'm not sure everybody knows about. What's something you've encountered recently in the archives that is cool or interesting? My emotional reaction to some of the material we have in our vault collection has surprised me. We don't pull out the North Carolina copy of the Bill of Rights very often because this is so old that at this point any light is damaging to it, and it has been digitized. It's available online, but when we pull these things out, we have an original copy of a constitutional reader from the period around the Grandfather Clause and the Jim Crow laws. The things that have happened in our history that were harder histories. It's that kind of stuff I find really emotionally resonant. On the flip side of that, I have worked as a digital archivist, so my fear is that the digital records that we have will never be quite as resonant because they're not physical. There's not a tangible kind of thing, and there's less of an opportunity to imagine someone using a pen to write a document. Our exhibits from digital records are going to be digital, and that's going to be a change I'm not sure people are ready for. The fact is, our history right now is digital. I did want to ask about America 250. How is your office preparing? We are really excited about America 250 because it's given us an opportunity through some of the funding initiatives to produce new exhibits that we can take around the state. Most of these will be one-day wonders, which means we roll in the morning, we set it up, it's open to the public throughout the day, then we take material back to make sure it's preserved the way it should be. We've produced a one-day wonder on the constitutional history within North Carolina. We have a one-day wonder on the experience of Revolutionary War soldiers in North Carolina. And we've also had the opportunity to put the 13th Amendment on display in the Capitol recently. The funny thing about most of our federal constitutional amendments, the official North Carolina copy of these is that they just look like a letter. There's nothing ceremonial about them. They were really just a legal document that we needed to ratify. So it's fun to see people interacting with that and asking questions. Well, what does that mean? How did this happen? What was the process? We really also want to get at more recent history and other ways that people have expressed their Americanness. That has given us opportunities to work with the African American Commission and the folks who work with indigenous groups here in the state to talk about what being American means to a wider range of people. It's also given us an opportunity to dive deeper into our own records. We don't have that much time or that many resources to devote to doing research internally, because a lot of the time we're helping others to do research, and that's the primary job. But this has given us an opportunity to get to know some of our records a little bit better. That's going to be great for the future. I'm curious if you're having to do a lot more advocating for public history, given the political climate. It has been challenging. It is what it is. Mostly it's a little bit discouraging when you feel like, especially the last 5 or so years, we had this opening up of understanding of what American history could be. What happened in the archives profession after the George Floyd murder was that we started thinking holistically about the stories that we have been historically telling, how we've been framing things, the kind of access we're providing, and whether or not there is bias in that access. These are really important questions to ask, no matter what the political climate, because it really gets to our core function, which is to provide access to these public records and other collections in a way that is equitable, and to answer each question as if it's the most important question, because we serve the people of North Carolina. To a certain extent, maybe that's gotten a little more difficult. Maybe we can't use the same vocabulary because that's become controversial, but our core mission stays the same. We're seeking to serve the folks of North Carolina who want to look at these records, who have questions that they want to answer using the records. We just keep on rolling and make our description better and make it easier for people to answer questions, whether they're controversial questions or run-of-the-mill questions that people of all political stripes can agree are important. It's also an opportunity for us to think about what we are here to do. We can do hard things, and it's just one more challenge. 2 or 3 years ago, it was super easy to run a cultural resource institution, and now we're struggling with some funding because of the federal cuts. We're looking for other ways to collaborate so we can make the most of resources that we have, But by and large, we're just focusing on our mission, and that mission is written in the general statutes. How are artificial intelligence and other shifts in digital technology shaping your priorities? We are definitely moving a lot of our operations toward the digital realm, just because that's where everything else is going. AI is particularly thorny for us. It could be a real boon to things like using large language models to do analysis on large collections of digital materials. Because of how easy it is to create digital records, there are a lot more of them than there were paper records back in the day. And so we have a lot of data that we need to be able to provide access to. AI could really help with that. On the flip side, AI is not trustworthy. If we are, you know, the stewards of this digital information, we have to look at AI as a risk. It's part of the conversation we're having with folks in the government agencies that we serve. It makes sense to use AI in business operations, and we get that. But we need to think very carefully about how AI is interacting with our records. Rogue AI programming has already been proven to take action on documents within cloud-based systems that they weren't authorized to take. It's a complicated sort of landscape when we know that people are going to use these things. How do we provide guidance so they're using them ethically and in a way that's not going to make it more difficult for us to do our jobs? We're going to have to remind people that it is not free to maintain these things if we're going to maintain them in a way that meets international standards for archival digital collections. There's constant work that it needs to be done to do that and help people understand that this is our history. It's a new technology. There was a time when paper was a new technology. So it's been a long time since we had to make a shift like that, but I think we're making that shift right now. There are a lot of thorny issues, I think I'll say right now. This is new, so we're all going to make mistakes. But hopefully, if we approach it responsibly and transparently and share our knowledge with people, we'll get to a good place with all of it. All right, next an article from Raleigh and the Raleigh Cares staff about the city's new crisis call diversion program. Raleigh's 911 call takers now assess whether callers are best served by the police or EMS, or if a mental health professional should respond instead. This article written on January 8th. Raleigh has made some big changes to how it handles 911 calls and mental health emergencies. When a Raleigh resident calls 911, a telecommunicator inside the city's emergency communication center asks them a series of screening questions over the phone. Until very recently, the main goal of those questions was to determine whether a crime had been committed and whether to dispatch police or EMS to the scene, according to Emergency Communications Director Dominic Nutter. Now, for the first time, 9/11 call takers are also paying attention to whether the caller might be experiencing a mental health crisis. They're assessing whether police officers are best equipped to respond to that situation or if a mental health professional should intervene instead. "We're refocusing," Nutter said. The reason for the change? Raleigh is piloting a crisis call diversion program, a team of licensed mental health clinicians embedded within the 911 call center who are trained to de-escalate mental and behavioral health crises and connect people with long-term support. The crisis call diversion program debuted just last November and is one component of Raleigh Cares. That's Crisis Alternative Response for Empathy and Support, CARES, the city's answer to community members' desire for more compassionate and specialized alternatives to policing. In developing CARES, the city took inspiration from programs like CAHOOTS, in Springfield, Oregon, Star in Denver, Colorado, and Heart in Durham. Each of these programs includes a crisis call diversion component to redirect mental health and substance use-related 911 calls to mental health professionals instead of police. Similar to this program called CAHOOTS, Crisis Assistant Helping Out on the Streets in Oregon. Raleigh is working with a private health care provider, Alliance Health, to staff this call diversion program. At this stage, three Alliance mental health counselors, Meg Hill, James Pierce, and Ashley Wilson, work out of that 9/11 center Monday through Friday from 9 to 5. City leaders plan to expand this service in the future. Well, the Indy spoke with these counselors, Nutter, and Raleigh Chief of Staff Michelle Mallette, one of the chief architects of the CARES program, about the crisis call diversion program. So this is a bunch of questions and answers, and I think I'll just leave the answers generic and not name who says it. When and why did Raleigh decide to pilot the crisis call diversion line? One of our former police chiefs, Cassandra Deck Brown, recognized there was a growing need, not just from community concern, but from a police resource standpoint, for an alternative for the community that was experiencing mental health crises. We decided we would embark on developing our call diversion line. Our wonderful director over at Emergency Communications jumped on board. One of the big things is, as we divert calls over to clinicians, it helps with our improved response time. If responders aren't going to those calls, they can focus on other calls where the public needs them, and it's going to reduce the time it takes us to get there. Additionally, with the clinicians, we now have experts handling the calls, so we enhance the service that we provide. We also have continuity of care. Alliance Health can provide follow-on care. That's the one thing our program has and other places don't. Question: what share of 911 calls qualify for this type of diversion? How many mental health calls are coming in on a given day? It's hard to formalize and give you a hard and fast number, because prior to us having a call diversion, we don't necessarily focus as much on it. Now that we are, and taking that additional look, Raleigh police are also doing the same as they go out and respond. So if you ask me that same question in about 4 months, I think we could properly frame that for you. I stress the importance of making sure our officers are trained through what's called crisis and intervention training. That CIT helps them know when they are out and interfacing with someone. Does this person actually need law enforcement, or does this person actually need care from a mental health standpoint? They are collecting data in the community to help us assess when to deploy other resources, in particular, ACORNs. That's Raleigh Police and Social Worker Co-Response Unit. Tell me how it works when someone calls 911 and how it gets filtered to the clinicians. What kind of questions are asked to make sure people get connected to the right call taker? A 911 call comes in, and we have our standard case entry questions. We're going to ask location, number, name. Then we're going to say, tell me exactly what happened. As they start explaining the situation, our team will start listening and decide if it's something that's appropriate for a crisis call diversion. The big thing is, does the person have a weapon? And is there any danger? In that case, then, diversion would not be appropriate. If it's something that's appropriate for crisis call diversion, then the call is transferred to a counselor. One of our telecommunicators will talk to the counselor first, so the counselor is aware of the situation, and then they will bring in the caller. Meg, James, and Ashley, tell me about your portion of the job and how a call might go. Pierce, we have a list of screening questions. We're screening for suicidality, homicidality, psychosis. Are they seeing things, hearing things? Also, substance abuse. The answers they give us determine their risk level, which is going to determine our response. Hill, Very often, people who call 9/11 in a mental health crisis may already be members of Alliance Health because it serves people with severe, persistent mental health challenges or intellectual developmental disabilities. When they are a member, we're able to follow up and make sure that there's support in place to help that person. Often, we are helping people access resources like behavioral health urgent care, crisis assessment, or mobile crisis. That's a service that comes to people's home and helps them figure out the best next steps for them while assessing that it's a safe step. Wilson. In the history of mental health, people usually don't have power of choice. A lot of times, when someone was having a mental health crisis, they were treated like a criminal, put in the back of a police car, and transported to whatever hospital was available. With us, we give choices. There's individuals that may need police or EMS to come out, but we talk to them about options. If you don't like going to Triangle Springs, no problem. There's Holly Hill. There's Raleigh Oaks. We give people choices because maybe they went to a doctor or a provider who was not helpful. So why go back there? Could you share some examples from the past couple months of successful call diversion? Pierce, I have a great example of a call came in from a young teenage man. He was suicidal, and I spoke with him, de-escalated him. It was about a 15-minute call. He did not like police, so it was good that I was able to speak with him, and we were able to divert that. By the end of the call, he was doing a lot better. He was linking with the support of his. Wilson, I have one individual I think about often. He called 9/11. He wasn't doing well. His provider had told him to go to Monarch Behavioral Health Urgent Care in Raleigh, and he went to a different location that was not an urgent care, and he was upset. We deemed it was safe for him to drive, and I gave him a list of options of different places. He said he wanted to go to Wake Recovery Response Center. I said, that's wonderful. When do you think you'll be there? I called him about the time he said he was going to arrive, and he was checking himself in, and he was happy. He found himself in the situation where he wasn't getting the help he thought he was going to get, and he reached out. It could have easily escalated to police needing to be involved, but because he was transferred to a counselor, we were able to get him where he needed to be. It's not just throwing him out in the wind and hoping that he got there. I made sure he was safe and got what he needed. Hill, I am thinking of a family I spoke to with an adult who was experiencing hallucinations. She wasn't wanting to hurt herself or anyone else, but she was having a hard time. The family ended up deciding for Alliance's mobile crisis service to come to their home. The mobile crisis responder comes in plain clothes, and it's a very family-friendly way to help when someone's at a lower level of risk. Sometimes people just say, I need someone to come and talk to me, to help me with strategies to get through the night. Going forward, do you see a demand to expand this pilot program with more counselors or longer hours? We're using the word pilot, says Nutter, but the program will not go away. This is just the first implementation. There is a demand. This initial iteration helps us to get an understanding of how we can make things flow better as we bring on additional counselor. Is there anything else Raleigh residents should know about this service or the people behind it? There are other services. There's that suicide and crisis hotline, 988. However, 988 is a regional service, and if there's a problem with the call, they're going to have to call us. Here the advantage is, since the counselors are part of our local team, we can easily work together to find a common solution. Even if it's a bad situation and police are on the scene, counselors can still play a part to ensure we have a more positive outcome. A counselor could intervene on the phone and reduce the chances of a negative outcome. Combined, we have, right now, over 3 decades of clinical experience. We're very skilled in crisis intervention work in a variety of different settings and populations. We're here and equipped to help. Okay, let's go on to a musical-related article. This by Sarah Edwards. It's called How Local Music Lovers Keep Music Discovery Fresh. There are plenty of ethical reasons to dump Spotify. In recent months, a number of artists, Zhuzhu, Deerhoof, and Durham's own Sylvan Esso, have done just that. Over the years, none of those reasons ever quite motivated me to overcome the tug of convenience and cancel my subscription. Then last month, I realized I wasn't actually even particularly enjoying that streaming service anymore. Spotify Wrapped came and went, with its unsettling promise to, quote, be more dynamic, personal, and unmistakably you than ever before. But its annual dopamine hit has dulled to a slight ping, both social and discovery aspects seemingly having evaporated into the algorithm. I listen to music a lot at the gym, at the office, on the bus, while walking my dog, or cooking dinner. A byproduct of this is that the practice of listening has become a bit less special, a way to block out the noise of the world rather than seek out new noise intentionally. Spotify's algorithms haven't helped this musical atrophy. I found myself cycling through the same 50 songs without brushing up against anything new. When I search for a playlist, I'm typically served these same songs, rearranged in a slightly different order under a title, Millennial Workout Mix, Main Character Energy, that seems very nearly designed to humiliate. Psychologists have a name for the gratification of computational reinforcement, algorithmic dependence. Taste as something to affirm a sense of self rather than taste as a mutable quality, something to challenge and expand the self. Journalist Liz Pelley in Mood Machine, The Rise of Spotify and the Cost of the Perfect Playlist, describes how Spotify has begun to stock its most popular playlists with commissioned music by ghost artists, that is, production companies, a process that cuts cost, phases out working artists, and pushes extractive practices to the fore. Pelley writes, this treatment of music is nothing but background sounds as interchangeable tracks of generic, vibe-based playlist fodder is at the heart of how music has been devalued in the streaming era. Pair this with Spotify's paltry artist payment model, and it's hard not to feel nihilistic. According to musician advocacy group United Musicians and Allied Workers, Spotify pays musicians roughly 1/4000th of a cent a song, meaning a listener must stream a song 236 times for an artist to earn $1. My most streamed song on Spotify in 2025 was Teeth Marks by S.G. Goodman, which I listened to 63 times. That means I paid S.G. Goodman about 25 cents for all the hours I spent listening to that beautiful song, a far cry what I would have paid in 2005, squirreling away babysitting money to buy a CD at Barnes & Noble. There are a handful of alternatives to Spotify, all of which vary in the degree to which they reinforce those same issues, Tidal, Apple Music, Deezer, and Napster, amongst others. This month I'm experimenting with a free trial of the French platform Qobuz, that's Q-O-B-U-Z. Parenthetically, I have been gifted with a subscription to Qobuz, and I'm waiting to try it but it certainly is different, particularly in the quality of the sound you get. All right, to continue with that article, Qobuz is considerably more artist-friendly than Spotify, with a royalty rate of a tenth of a cent to 2/10 of a cent per stream. It provides editorial features like in-depth digital liner notes, artist interviews, and album reviews. On a casual stroll of the Discovery page, I encountered Lee Morgan's jazz album, Cornbread, 1965, and 10 Tricks Points Never Ambient Replica, 2011, alongside recommendations for Brazilian funk, hip-hop, trip, blues, and a hefty amount of classical music. There are ways to migrate your playlists from Spotify. That's good. Some, like say a certain 46-minute Steely Dan breakup playlist, 2021, couldn't and shouldn't be spiritually rebuilt from scratch. I'm not an audiophile and didn't think I'd notice the difference in quality, but the sound is much crisper than Spotify and goes further toward capturing the magic of live music. Listening to artist Natalie Bergman earlier this week, there were a few songs that made me feel like I was standing in a dark warehouse, a crackle in the air, reverb glancing off a concrete floor. There are drawbacks. GoBuzz catalog is smaller than Spotify. Its price point is higher. I paid $12 a month for Spotify, and after my trial ends, will pay $15 per month for GoBuzz. Audiobooks are not available, so I added another app, the library's Libby app, to my phone's roster, and we'll see if we stick with it. My New Year's resolution led to broader questions. How do other people find new music? In an age of infinite discovery, where to begin and how to integrate habits of discovery into daily life? How to retain access to beloved music and still stumble upon new favorites? How to keep music habits ethical, local, and, asking for a friend, for brains used to solving decision fatigue with mindless streaming, how to keep the resolution to stay off Spotify. To learn more, I emailed a few local music lovers to ask. The results were unanimous. Go to local shows, support local creators, and talk to your friends. The capitalist suture pulling to keep consumer culture together is finally bursting at the seams, so we're uplifting indie artists and each other, babes. That means paying all artists fairly for their time, work, and expertise, which is why the best way to keep your music tastes fresh, support your local DJs. It's our job to curate soundscapes that scratch your brain and bring you euphoria in these dark times, whether on the dance floor or your earbuds. So, show up to our events, pay the cover, let loose. You can even tip us if you want. Another. The local scene is teeming with talent. Start at the clubs. The Conjure curates dance parties around the sound of black femme magic. No Visa, brought to you by the global, legendary DJ and producer Alec Lomami, visual artist Mike Tambashi, and event producer Ngamit Keita, bops around the triangle with local DJs and phenoms from around the world, sharing original tracks that span genre and culture. Femme Fragments, led by Poetic Note, puts together a stellar all-femme lineup every other month at Ruby's in Durham, often featuring vinyl sets with an expansive range of house and techno. Wilco and its connecting mezcal bar La Veladora gave Raleigh a burst of culture, with DJs playing every Thursday evening, most weekends, and at the Pan Comido events on Sunday for a tropical feel, all curated by DJ K. Ward. Fun fact, much of my musical tastes have been shaped by K. Ward's mixed CDs, which he used to hand out to club goers 20 years ago. To catch budding artists early, longtime producer and DJ Tree City of Party Illegal hosts Blends with Friends every first Wednesday at the Pinhook. Anyone can roll up with a loaded USB stick and plug in for a 20-minute set. I felt so much freedom dancing at all these parties, discovering new music along the way. Following and supporting amazing local DJs and producers on social media will lead you to ways to buy their music. And then there's the classic internet stalking method. Find a DJ's Bandcamp or SoundCloud and peruse their favorites to create playlists all your own. Now, all of those above things was by Victoria Boulibasis. And let's see. I'm almost done with my time. Let me check my time available. Well, the article continues with more contributions from visiting commenters, so to speak. So I'll let that go right now and just glance on a food and drink article by Jasmine Gallup. As Western wake grows, so does a polished, modern Indian restaurant dining scene. And we better have some food because I'm getting hungry. And it begins, if you're in search of good Indian food in the Triangle, you don't have to look far. A short drive through Western Wake County will take you past a dozen great options, whether it's casual curry joint with extra spicy vindaloo or a strip mall eatery where you'll be treated like family. These are restaurants that offer more than just American interpretations of classic Indian dishes. On most menus, past the chicken tikka masala and garlic naan, you'll find dishes local to specific South Asian regions, food from North India and the Punjabi region, South India and Tamil Nadu, and the Nepalese Himalayas. The culinary diversity found in Apex, Kerry, and Morrisville reflects that area's growing international population. In 2023, the most recent year for which data is available, Morrisville had the highest population of people identifying as Asian Indian at 34.3%. That number doubled since 2010, when the percentage of people identifying as Asian Indian was around 17%. Thousands of people attend Kerry's Asia Fest each year, and in the fall, Kerry and Morrisville each hold events for Diwali, the Festival of Lights, celebrated widely across India. And as that community grows, so does an appetite for Indian food, represented this winter by a burst of new restaurants on the scene. Kara, modern Indian and upscale modern space, opened in October. Just a few months later, in December, Chief Preeti Waz opened a new cafe, Chini, in RTP. This April, popular Kerry restaurant Urban Angiti plans to reopen following a massive renovation. And, well, we can hear the music telling us it's time to get off the air. And this broadcast, which will be first listened to on Friday, will be put in the podcast bin for listening at any time. And John Federson now will say so long to you listeners from the North Carolina Reading Service, which has enjoyed bringing you this presentation of the Independent Indie Week, indieweek.com, if you want to see it on a computer screen. So long. See you next week.